2000 AD, 40 years of Thrill Power Festival, kicking it old school. Borag Thung, Earthlitz, and welcome to a supplemental episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. At the beginning of February, we had a fantastically successful 40th anniversary event, and it was an incredible day. Over 1,000 Squatstick Thargo, over 100 creators, all crammed into the Novotel in Hammersmith in London for a day of panels and signings and sketchings and just general fun. And all the feedback we've had has been absolutely wonderful. So thank you to everybody who came. Now, we appreciate that not everybody could get tickets, so we thought we would bring the event to you. So in between episodes of the 2000 AD Thrillcast, we're going to be bringing you panels recorded at the 40 years of Thrill Power Festival. And this week, it's the turn of Kicking It Old School with John Higgins, Jesus Redondo, and Ian Kennedy. Now, they all talk to their host, John Freeman, about working on early 2000 AD, but also lots of other different titles from the heyday of British comics. Now, Jesus was talking through an interpreter, so there will be some moments when the sound isn't so good, so apologies for that, but do bear with it because there's some absolute gems in this fantastic panel.
Afternoon, everybody. Thank you very much for coming. We're going to blast away from 2008 a little bit, but I'm sure we'll steer the questions in this panel to pretty much 2008 and mention other comics as well, because nobody wants to talk about other comics really here. Thank you very much for coming to the 2000 AD at 40. We have some great guests here. I'll start on this side with John Higgins. Call you a veteran because you're always young to me. Ian Kennedy, well known for masses of work, and Jesus Redondo. Can we have a bit of a clap for them, the three of them first? Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. It's not just come from the end of the country. So I've got a sort of set questions, partly to ask, but obviously we'll also let you ask some as well if you so wish. And I've got a few props with me that you can marvel at, perhaps, although there aren't any Marvel titles in there at all, really. Okay, let's start with Jesus. What was your first work in comics?
My first was in 61 years in the century, last century. I'm something old. I don't remember. Well, it was a job with a stupid characters that fall in love frequently. It's a problem. And was a very bad work. I don't remember well. It was my first work, but...
First work?
Yeah. I can't understand now how it was possible the editor pay me for my work.
Oh, modest as ever. Ian, you started at DC Thompson.
Yes, that's correct. Yes, back in 49 when I left school. I'd had a bit of coaching beforehand by a friend of the family who was an artist in Thompson's.
Yeah.
And he eventually got me my job in the art studio there. I owe an awful lot to the people who populated the studio at that time. Wonderful, talented artists who kept me on the right road. If I didn't, I got plenty of stick. But my first ever job is pretty well known now, inking in the blacks in the Sunday Post crossword. And then we gravitated to doing, I think it was The Wizard, had a little section which they called the Quick Tick Quizzes. And they had little sketches and three alternative answers. And I did the little sketches, and that was my very first publish in comics.
And of course, you did quite a variety of strips, didn't you?
Yes, eventually.
Not just the strips that you were known for, the boys, but you did some girls' comics as well.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Eventually, I worked for Bunty and Judy. These were the two that spring to mind.
Yeah, yeah. John.
wasn't for you, wasn't it? I think
possibly.
I think one of the things I really enjoyed about like starting in the business was these two are my heroes. It's easy for me to say that because they're sitting next to me, but these two, like particularly in colour, because I was like a colour artist right from the beginning. It's like Black and White Line, which is Jesus is such an incredible artist that. So like colour was my sort of like back right from the very beginning. And Ian always seemed to be there before me. Whenever I went in to look and learn, Ian was always the guy who's like, the art was shown to me. That's what you need to do to get work in this business, basically. But probably someone actually remembered 2000 AD. Probably the first paid work I did was the cover for 2000 AD. And I think they said, they actually remembered it was issue 47. So I've actually been working for 2000 AD for 40 years on and off, which is quite scary. So I'm looking forward to the 80th anniversary. You must have
Well, that's brought my next question. What was your first work for 2000 AD, John?
Oh, right.
But we worked together on Doctor Who.
Yeah, that was probably early 80s.
Early 80s, a bit later on, yeah. Yeah. So what was your first work for 2000 AD, Ian?
It's difficult to remember, but I suspect difficult to remember, but I think it was probably doing a Judge Dredd.
Yeah.
On 2000 AD.
Anybody name it?
The Invasion Stories,
yeah.
Very early.
Oh, they were 2000 AD. The Invasion Stories. That's correct.
You have to remember that wasn't just 2000 AD. Many years ago, there was actually a lot more comics, and sometimes people worked on a lot more comics.
Yeah, I think there was
very difficult.
Cool. Somebody Google it. Was it Ant Wars? What was your
the primer trabajo para la primera.
First 2080? Which was the first one you enjoyed?
My first work for United Kingdom, I did it because I have an agent. And I don't know what were the magazine for what I was working.
Was this the Bardon agency?
During years.
Yeah.
And during years, the editors never sent me a copy of my work. And the original, completely lost.
Yeah, well, I mean, when if you speak to some of the guys who worked on Dan Dare in the 1960s, the writers, they never actually met the artist. These days, like, the editor doesn't get a word in edgeways with somebody when you're working on a project. So, like, what do you mean you spoke to him about that? I need to tell him. There's a bit getting used to that sort of thing. So, can you remember how you felt about, well, obviously, if you don't know whether you were working on 2080, this is a daft question, but I was wondering, can you remember how you felt about getting work for British Comics? Was it?
Really not. No. But translate, please.
Yeah, yeah.
Si sé lo que siento ahora. I know what I feel
translate.
Now.
Yeah, you say in Spanish. I'll say it in English. Sí.
Actualmente hago algunos trabajos, pero no en cómics, sino en libros para niños para Estados Unidos. Mm-hmm.
Well, he didn't know back in the day what it meant to work for 2000 AD, but he does know now. And these days he's doing a lot of children's books for the US.
Yes.
Tengo varias experiencias con Marvel y ahora contaré otra muy interesante con DC. Y he trabajado para otras editoriales más pequeñas, pero cuando yo he sido más feliz en mi trabajo ha sido cuando yo he trabajado en revistas para Inglaterra, para el Reino Unido.
And on top of those children's books, he's also worked for Marvel, DC, and other smaller publishers. But the best time he's ever had working on comics, it's been for British publishers.
Hey! Let's phrase it slightly differently for you, because you've worked in comics pretty much all your life, apart from the crossword filling in.
Yes, that's correct.
Are there particular 2000 AD strips that you remember more than others you've worked on, or is there?
I do remember being prompted about the Invasion series. I did enjoy working on them, because they involved things like Vulcan bombers and that sort of thing, which I love drawing and painting. Anything with an aviation content or very much up my street.
Because you did quite a lot of strips with in the 90s for Barry Tomlinson, didn't you, which got a lot more aeroplanes and
that's jets that's and, correct, yes. Uh-huh. And it was really, I think the 2000 AD stuff we were talking about was back in the 70s. And then I had a bit of a car accident in around about 81, 82. And I was just recovering from that when Barry got in touch with me. The new Dan Dare, the grandson, I think, of the original, had come on stream. Yes, and the artist wasn't, I don't think he was too happy with working on the series. Pat Mills was the author at the time.
He was, yes.
Yes, and they decided that they would come along and ask me, because, as I say, I was getting back into harness after the accident, and I was asked if I would take it over, and it sounded very attractive. So I took it over, and, well, the rest history.
And you, John, what was your, of the 2000 AD strips, which is the one that you favourite 2000 AD strip that you've drawn?
It has to be Dredd. I mean, it's like, I'm a huge fan of Dredd. I was lucky in a way because even though I've been working with 2000 AD for 40-odd years, I wasn't allowed to do Dredd until I'd improved enough to get to these guys' standards. And I was a huge fan of sort of like Brian Bald and Mick McMahon and these guys. And when I got the opportunity, so I've been a fan for probably about 5, 6, 7, 8 years before I actually got the opportunity to work on Judge Dredd full time. And even now, I look forward to the next Judge Dredd strip I do. Some of the writers we have nowadays, you know, Al Ewing, Mike Carroll, and so on. And obviously, John Wagner is still writing stuff now that's completely enough to be relevant and exciting. I'm just a huge fan of 2000D. Huge fan of Judge Dredd, and I'm so excited every time I get the opportunity to work on him.
Which, funnily enough, leads me to my next question is, why is it your favourite character in 2000 AD?
I think the template that was set all those years ago, it gives an opportunity for every individual artist to stamp a little bit of their personality onto this character. But like, because of what Mick McMahon and Brian Bolland in particular set in place, it's an immediately recognisable character, which is just a wonderful, how you can make something look almost like a cartoon caricature, yet be so realistic and so in your face. It's just the talent of the template that was set in place all those years ago.
And Ian, obviously, you mainly now you do cover work and illustration work.
Yes.
But if you were doing a strip, is there a 2000 AD character you'd like to draw?
Well, strangely enough, although I had difficulty with Judge Dredd originally, because when I was asked to do him, he was just a wee bit, how can I say, brutal. from my point of view, he wasn't quite Dan Dare. Dan Dare was a wee bit more civilized, shall we say. But the brutality of Judge Dredd did put me off a wee bit. But now, I really do enjoy Judge Dredd. And Strontium Dog, of course.
Yeah.
I think I've grown into these characters myself.
Yes, is there a 2000 AD character you would love to draw now?
¿Hay un personaje que te gustaría dibujar ahora? ¿O de los que has dibujado con este Pablito?
No, especialmente. Cualquier personaje que me encargaran ahora, yo lo haría con muchísimo gusto.
Not especially, but he would be more than happy to work on any of the publisher's characters
aunque
at this point.
Sería muy difícil porque los dibujantes que están haciendo personajes en 2010 son muy buenos.
Although it would be quite difficult because the competition is quite fierce.
Obviously, I mean, the market's changed. I mean, there's 2000 AD and there's Labino in Britain. But there are obviously more comics, and you're working for American publishers, and you worked for American publishers for years. Is there? Do you think there's new developments like digital comics and other things are going to help the comics form continue, because I think people do get concerned when you look at the sales figures for all the comics. I mean, when we were doing Overkill and Havoc, I mean, I actually dug out the sales figures for the Marvel UK titles, and like the first issue sold like 96,000 copies, which I think most publishers would kill for now. Mm-hmm. But is that a way forward? I've rambled a bit, I do apologize.
Digital is not my favorite aspect of art, illustration, or publication. But all the publishers really jumped into doing digital before it was proven to be as successful as they were hoping. And what we found, when I do read and research, because I don't want to be put out of work, basically. So, and I know it's like the sales figures seem to be going down in so many different ways. But I don't think digital is particularly, to read, I just find it's pointless, because digital can do so many other things and just do static imagery. So it's not comics as far as I'm concerned. But one of the things they have found is like, you know, it's almost like a market loss leader. If you're a big enough company like DC and Marvel and maybe Rebellion, you can actually release some work initially on digital. And it's like just, 10-page advert for the series that are coming up subsequently. And that actually leads to sales, you know, hard copy sales. And that's what we want, is hard copy sales. So as an advertising avenue, I think it's a very good direction. You can't make money at it, as far as I can see.
No, I was doing digital comics for like 4 years and never made any money.
Sorry.
No. So, I mean, we were doing the audio comics, and it just didn't. Yeah. Although critically, people were interested in it. It didn't. People still wanted that printed page, and Egmont's done some research to indicate that kids prefer the tactile nature. Even though kids trying to get kids to read comics is still hard. I mean, there are no kids in the audience here whatsoever, so we can be rude if we want. But I mean, Oh, right. So, which comics do you read?
He's just beginning to enjoy 2018.
Excellent. Converted to the cause. Well, I'm hoping, although I don't think anything's been announced this weekend, as far as I'm aware, that there will be a lot of a classic Egmont characters coming back into print, whether in reprint or originated, which would be nice to see, because I'm sure there's plenty of characters like Roy of the Rovers could be. I mean, intriguingly, sports comics, although might not be popular here unless you're a big fan of Mina Arena or whatever, the Roy of the Rovers is still a character that the people outside of comicdom know really well, the Roy of the Rovers moment and things like that. And the same, to a certain extent, goes for Dan Dare and Dennis the Menace, and then Judge Dredd. I think those are and the granny from Giles' cartoons. They're the five that people know of outside of comicdom. Have you done any? Are there any digital comics that you've worked? Have you worked on any?
No. It's kind of passed me by, John. Maybe it's because they realise that poor old Kennedy's brain just can't handle the digital side of things. I think possibly it's too late for me to partake of that side of things. I'm lucky enough to still be able to spend my time working in the old primitive style, shall we say.
Yes, we've seen some of your work online where you've been working up at the Dundee College showing people how you do your Mekong.
That sort of thing, yes. And I'm enough in demand to keep me occupied in that respect. So that I suppose it panders to my innate, laziness. That I haven't really extended myself digitally. Yeah. Okay. I haven't had to.
No. In Spain, is the comic market still buoyant? Is there still strong sales for comics there?
¿Cómo es la situación del cómic en el mercado español?
A calamity.
A calamity.
En España hay muchos buenos autores, grandes dibujantes, que en España no pueden publicar porque los precios que pagan son muy pocos. En España, si venden 2.000 ejemplares, es un rotundo éxito. Y eso
Well, he was just saying that in Spain there's a lot of really great talent, but they cannot really make a living if they were to work with these Spanish publishers because the rates they pay are simply ridiculous. And he was saying that, for example, if a title sells around like 2,000 copies, it would be like a rotund success.
Es imposible trabajar así. En Francia me preguntaron una vez esto mismo, una familia, y yo le contesté que en España estaba muy mal. Y aquella familia, el padre me dijo, entonces, ¿qué leen allí?
And he just said that whilst in France, a French couple in the house he was staying at asked what the situation of comics was like in Spain. And he told them that it was awful. And then the father in the family said, so what do people read over there? Right. Just an example as to...
Well, because in France, comics are ingrained in the blood. I mean, they're talking to people here today, our young aspiring creators, I think there's a sense of frustration that there isn't as many options for publishers to take on new blood, which is a bit, I think, is sad now. I mean, because we didn't have that experience. There were plenty of options to opportunities for lots of our, you know, DC Thompson had a huge range of comics. IPC had a huge range of titles. Which is, are there any creators in the audience here who've been working, you know, doing their own comic project and that sort of thing? And, yeah, so it's hard to find ways to jump from the independent, self-published, into something that's paid work. There aren't that many options. Do you think there's a way around that, or is it just a matter of persevering?
One of the things I have noticed in a lot of other conventions is the fact that you get a lot of small, independent, really well-produced comics on sales. Like people who have jobs that pay them, that can help them pay the bills, their love is comics. So they produce their own comics, and the quality of work is just quite mind-blowing. Mm. So I think there's an enthusiasm for comics that's like, will never, ever go away. It's like you just hope people, I think we are very, very lucky that us three in particular have made a living out of doing this. I've been doing this for 40 years, and I've made a living doing this. I think it's still possible for people to break into the business nowadays. But there's, as you say, in the old days, we're just catching up with these guys. And when we used to go to IPC, King's Reach Tower, I mean, there was like floors of, you know, 30 floors of magazines, you know, as a student going into this place. It was like the hallowed halls of, you know, publishing. You know, people could make a living. They actually had a canteen. I couldn't believe it, you know, when I was taken to the canteen. And, you know, nowadays, if you look, as much as I love working for Rebellion, I don't think it has a canteen for its staff. So
no, I don't think so. No, I mean, I went around, went around the sad days, last days of King's Reach Tower, when they were literally emptying offices of things, throwing stuff into skips. And you go upstairs to what might have been Tharg's central headquarters, and it was empty, and the carpet had been ripped out, sort of. Sadly, we're now replaced by strange other buildings on that side. But obviously, as you said, there are a lot of young people who were our age. You know, when we all started, there are people still wanting to draw comics. And if you do a kid's workshop, there's kids that are wanting to draw comics and have fun, you know, drawing their Dennis the Menace or Judge Dredd or whatever. But it's just hard for them to make that jump now. So
yeah, I think as we know, it's like Ian takes classes up in Edinburgh at Aberdeen University.
Yes, I am asked from time to time to go down to the College of Art there, and there is what they call a comic module. They've been running it for quite a few years now, and we go down, and the students, of course, are very interested in finding out how we did it back in prehistoric times. And, of course, they're into digital putting it together.
Yeah.
But it's wonderful to watch them. They still have to do their initial sketches, and the talent is there. And then, of course, to my mind, they download it. I think that's the right term. And it loses life. It becomes terribly bland. Mm. I keep hoping Phil Vaughan, one of the chaps that I liaise with at the college, we have this little joke that sooner or later, on the end of the keyboard, once they've downloaded the stuff into the computer, there'll be this little key at the end which will have AL marked on it, artist license. Ah. And when you press that, it becomes alive again. but there's no doubt about it. From the Luddite point of view, there is a definite improvement ongoing in the way that the computer can start grading color, portraying nice, perhaps, sunsets, that sort of thing, instead of just a straight flat pink or a straight flat yellow. We're beginning to get gradations of color and tone, which is very welcome from my point of view, very much so.
Well, I mean, because when you're talking my favorite. Your favorite.
That was my favorite.
The champion. All that's actually done from done at the printing stage. The colouring actually coloured at print stage. It wasn't done on straight to the print.
Yes, that was my favorite when I was in my teens.
Is there a difference between the way American publishers treat creators and British publishers treated creators in the past? Because as I mentioned earlier, artists and writers never talked to each other in British publishing for a long time until more recently, thanks to people like Pat Mills, who made sure that there was that communication between. Is your experience different with American publishers?
I think it changed. I think Vertigo changed things for the American publishers because it was predominantly British creators anyway. So I think we took our work practices out there. The last series I did for Vertigo was Jacked, and I worked very closely with the writer on that. So I think things have changed. But I think when you see British writers working for the American companies, they seem, in my opinion, seem to have lost something. The adventurous, the adventurous goes out of what they're writing. There seem to be slight constraints that we don't get in 2000 AD. So I think the superhero stuff, there's a template that you have to stick to, and even the best writers from 2000 AD seem to be slightly more mainstream. It's like it's not so exciting when they transfer to America. I think it's probably similar as well when we do artwork, and particularly when you're doing superhero artwork like Jesus. The sort of stuff that we have to do is to conform to their designs.
You work to a template?
Yo prefiero el cómic europeo y, desde luego, el cómic inglés es donde yo mejor he desarrollado mi trabajo.
He says that his sensibilities are with the European market, and he definitely prefers the way the British market operates. And he was able to realize how much better things were in the UK when he started working for Marvel. And he also added at the end that he's not trying to suck up to anyone. That it's he's not trying to be nice, but saying what he's saying. But it's simply the truth.
But there's definitely that. I mean, that's the thing about 2000 AD, and with a lot of British comics, is that you were able to get away with a lot more. And there were even with some of the licensed comics. I'm thinking about Real Ghostbusters, where although it was a licensed comic, I mean, Richard Starkings, bless him, really pushed the envelope as to what you could get away with and what we could write and draw on it. There's still that. So there's that anarchy that comes to British creators that's fighting against the template.
Yeah, very much so. And plus the fact in America, they have like massive censorship from outside. Mm-hmm. It's like Walmart, sales figures can dictate what you're going to put in your books, whereas in the UK, that doesn't happen. So there is a censorship in American books that we just don't get. And it really is censorship, which I find quite... we don't get a sense of censorship in European books, and certainly 2000 AD, so...
Yeah, I mean, I think to a certain extent that's true, but I mean, but if you look at the comics, unfortunately, 2000 AD isn't on sale in supermarkets, but the supermarkets have controlled how comics are marketed in their stores, so they've got to have a free gift on them. That tap that you don't like in plastic bags, or comics that you can't read because they're in a plastic bag, is because supermarkets demanded it in the 1990s because sales started to decline. And they also want a higher price point, so your comics aren't cheap. So if you, Peter Stanbury and Paul Gravett mentioned in the past that they think that, you know, if you looked at the price of comics in the 1970s and 80s, you look at the price of 2000 AD, it's about the price of a chocolate bar. Yeah. Whereas now, you'd have to put your, it's the price of four chocolate bars, and people people aren't buying, they're not experimenting with comics. They're not able to buy, they used to buy, maybe buy Sparky and 2000 AD, or Sparky and Battle, Star Wars. You could buy them. Did other people find that growing up? Did you experiment and try out, like, Thunder, for example, which was launched in 1972, and which Rebellion now owns? Adam Eterno, please. But there is that, isn't there? You were able to try something out. If you didn't like Mighty World of Marvel, you wouldn't buy it again, but you could. There were plenty of other things to you could afford. Yes, gentleman with a hat.
Chris Loder, Jack Adrian. I was on the first issue of Star-Lord, amongst other things. We had to cut up the artwork. We had to revise everything. I mean, the first issue as it came out, when we saw it, we were saying, Jesus, this is terrific, because it should have been a complete mess. and it wasn't. And I mean, we worked extremely hard, you know, to get it. Pat's story, Something of the Damned, Planet of the Damned, that's right, they went through the Bermuda Triangle or something. Mm. Well, that was a brilliant artist. As I remember, it should have been, we had the artwork, which should have been twice up, okay? Twice the size of...
Yeah.
And in fact, we were using the original artwork, and it was actually drawn to be printed as twice up. And in fact, when it appears, you'll see there's lots of straggly scratchings and dark, terrible blackness. It was done as half up. The process was, it was done as half up from the page. But, Star-Lord was, it was a terrific paper. We knew, everybody on that paper knew that it was basically the men in suits opening up a new paper, which in 20 weeks would go into 2000 AD and stuff the circulation.
This is what you call the hatch, match, and dispatch.
That's
treatment.
The one. Yes,
yeah, where
yes.
Titles would. My first experience of that was Thunder back in 1972.
Yes. Yeah.
Where it lasted for 22 issues, and then was merged with Lion.
Lion, that's right.
And of course, you yourself will have experienced many times where the management interfered going back into the 1960s.
Yes. The curse of Lion was that it took in everything, and then right at the end was taken in by Valiant. And the reason we were doing better, the Lion was doing better than Valiant circulation-wise. He was doing miles better than Valiant. But Valiant wasn't going to go because it was a creation of the then editor-in-chief, Jack LeGrand.
Yeah.
And he wasn't going to see Lion, which had been going since 1952 or something. He wasn't going to let Lion take over Valiant. He was because it was his comic. So we got in and got out.
Talking on Twitter a couple of days ago, when the ABCs for the last 6 months of 2016 were published, and people were celebrating it, the sales of 36,000 on the Beano. Barry Tomlinson, who of course edited New Eagle, working with these chaps as well, pointed out that people would be jumping out the windows at King's Reach Tower if a title sold under 250,000 copies a week. And there was certainly, I mean, I said I actually dug out, I've got them here, I actually have, if anybody wants to be really boring and tedious, I actually have sales figures for some of the Marvel UK titles from 1992, which, as I mentioned, I know I keep, I'm one of these people who keeps everything. I can't help it. My wife hates me because it's all in the attic now. But it's sort of, you're looking at 96,000 for a fully reprint title. This was Havoc, which lasted 12 issues and was one of Paul Neary's babies. But you can see why Marvel UK did reprint titles when you haven't got to actually originate anything apart from on Fury, where they originated, for example, and got Carlos Esquerra to draw the covers. And that we were always fighting against that at Marvel UK.
Yeah.
We were all, inside, we were trying to get them to originate, and Richard Starkings certainly wanted to get them to originate, but the only reason we originated on Real Ghostbusters was because there was nothing to reprint from. And you...
I don't want to hog the microphone, but I just want to say it's absolutely wonderful to see Ian there, who I thought was dead 40 years ago. And Ian, I have a great a tendresse for Ian because he did one of my better stories. He did the story of Bill Savage in the Harrier jump jet bursting through the Channel Tunnel, which hadn't even been
built. I remember it well, Chris.
But you had wonderful, wonderful artwork. Absolutely brilliant.
Well, actually, I'm sure there are a lot of people in the room who are delighted to see that you're in the back of the room as well, Chris.
I don't know.
I wasn't aware you were here today, so it's fantastic that to hear your...
I had a good signing.
Good. let's have another question from the audience, because I think that must have prompted some memories. Yes.
Did you ever meet any of the people that you're cooperating with, or was it always via telephone and letter and things like that?
Well, you wouldn't work directly with a writer, would you?
It was a case of the writer would write the script. The script would then be vetted by the editor, and the editor would send it out to me. From time to time, we might liaise on the telephone just to make sure of little points here and there. But that was the general system, right, Chris?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is this the same for you?
Well, in the case of Jesus, In the case of Jesus, not only did he not speak to the writer, he didn't even talk to the editor because all the work was done through an agency.
Yeah.
And just to put it as an example, it was only until... not until like 8 or 9 years ago that he realized he had worked with Alan Moore in more than one title. He simply didn't know what he was doing or what he was doing for.
Yeah, because the agencies generally they would be sent the scripts and they would handle the translation of the scripts into Spanish for the artist to work from. And in the case of South American artists, a lot of the South American artists wouldn't even see the dialogue on a script. They'd just see the panel descriptions and work from those. And when it came back into your offices, then you rewrote the story to fit. A lot of the time, just in the same way that Stan Lee sometimes did at Marvel. When we were working at Marvel UK and in early 2000 AD days, all the scripts would go through the editor. There would be no direct contact. Even if you knew that you drank with Alan Moore in a pub, you wouldn't necessarily be working. You'd still be working through the editor.
Yeah, the editor filtered everything. And so they placed the right artist with the right writer. It worked, and certainly, you know, going back and remembering how badly sometimes the artwork was treated in other offices, 2000 AD did seem to treat the artists and the artwork in a way that wasn't general throughout, like, IPC in those days.
They didn't use it as formats, for example, Frank Hansen's work on Down There. Yeah.
But I remember it's like the classic days when it's like you just sign away the rights, you know, on the back of the check.
Yeah. But in actual fact, the NUJ actually ruled that was actually illegal, so it doesn't actually count. So anybody who's done that, could start arguing the toss. Yeah. Let's have another question from the yes.
Yeah, my question would be on you're talking there about 2000 AD treating the artist a little bit better. Of course, the big breakthrough was that the artist got credit lines. After a time.
Yeah.
Now, this obviously opened up a lot of career opportunities and allowed the artist to move into other to other publishers. But looking back, could it be argued that perhaps it wasn't such a great thing because the flip side was a lot of good British talent got siphoned off elsewhere?
Yeah, there is that. I mean, obviously, Ian will remember this in that DC Thompson guarded their artists and their creative talent pool with absolute secrecy, and you weren't supposed to be working for other publishers at one point.
Oh, no. Certainly when I went freelance, actually, I went freelance completely in that the local agent got work for me immediately from Amalgamated Press in Farringdon Street. and that was the that's where my freelance career kicked off. So it was really a case of working for some time with AP, and then gradually Thomson's decided, a particular editor decided, that he would overrule the general feeling in Thomson's. At least that's the impression I had. And he said, no, I want Ian to come and do the Commando covers, because he'd been watching the Air Ace and World Picture Library. That was it. That was where the Commando cover episode started off.
Yeah, but certainly you're right. There was no credits on any British comics, and if you and it was only thanks to Pat, wasn't it, John, that creators got credit, and as a result of creators getting credit on 2000 AD, it was spread by David Hunt into Battle and on other titles as well. But yeah, I suppose once DC Comics knew who the writers and artists were, that might have helped. But you still didn't have the internet. You still had to track them down and find Alan Moore on his sticky carpet in Northampton. but you wouldn't necessarily, I mean, you'd still, it's not as easy now. I mean, if I'm looking for art, a particular art style, I can go on to DeviantArt. Or, strangely, there are now, just like with Bardon was in the 1960s and some of the agencies that you might have worked with, that there are a lot of companies now in France and in South America who I deal with now, who are putting a bunch of artists forward. Although I'm actually in the past in contact directly with some of the artists I work with, like Joe Pimentel, for example, now works for an agency in South America because he can't find work directly. It's hard for him to sell himself because he has that problem with the language barrier and presenting himself to. Has that been an issue in the past, to sell yourself, to be known in Britain?
Well, even though these days he doesn't work with an agent and hasn't done so for quite a number of years, he still finds some issues in getting actual work. As much as an editor might be very complimentary on their work, that might not translate into any actual deal.
Yes, I think did that answer your question in terms of people being headhunted? Did you get headhunted as a result of people knowing who you were in 2000 AD by Karenberger and Co?
Not DC came over in the mid 80s. Alan Moore was was the spearhead of the whole British invasion, really, and then Dave Gibbons very soon after. But we actually went out, or they went out to actually tout for work, and I think probably they did know the names anyway, but you just had to go out and search for it. But when DC started sending over their editors en masse, in the mid-80s...
Yeah, to the UCAC convention.
Yeah. They used to do portfolio reviews for any artist, but obviously 2000 AD, you got the foot in the door before they'd arrived. So yes, having a credit really helpful, but you still have to go out there and do it. I mean, there are a lot of artists who might have got credits who still didn't break through into the American market for one reason or another.
Yeah, and Archie Goodwin at Marvel, and Marvel did exactly the same thing. Although Marvel had a presence in the UK since 1972, a lot of the material, as I mentioned earlier, was reprint material, and there was a very small editorial base. But slowly that changed. Richard Starkings, who now runs Comicraft, the lettering company, he was instrumental in trying to get originated material into Marvel UK. And it expanded from there under Paul Neary with a huge number of books that he put out. And they filled a gap in the market for the Americans, in that Marvel, to a certain extent, Marvel US were looking for books to keep Image Comics off the shelves in the new direct sales market. And that's not an unknown tactic. I mean, IPC did exactly the same thing in the 1960s to keep DC Thompson new titles off the shelves. For example, Sparky, which is a humor comic, was launched exactly the same week as TV21. So bizarrely, a strange sort of comparison. Maybe, I don't know whether there was some sort of secrecy going on with TV21 and they thought it was going to be a humor comic. But there's always been that attempt to sort of keep the market share big when you see a competitor like Image rising because they were a successful book. And one reason that, a little bit of an aside, but one reason that Marvel Comics was a success in the 1960s was because they got books out no matter what, every month, on time, and the retailer got them. And both DC Thompson and IPC are exactly, you would never have a comic run late. It just couldn't. Whatever was in it, it had to be out at the right time. And that was why, when the direct sale market started up, retailers were more likely to buy a Marvel book, because it was more likely to be on time, whereas Image Comics might not be. And of course, that never happened with any Image book whatsoever, did it? That's,
could I have a word with John for a moment?
Yes, of course you can. You ask him a question.
John, you obviously have had quite a bit of experience with American comics. Personally, I never even had a whiff of an approach from America, which I'm not too unhappy. I was quite happy in my own little nook. But how did you find, which would you have rather worked for, the American style of work or back in the UK here, which was more comfortable?
I prefer the British style of working. You know, funnily enough, Jesus and I were talking about the inking. Mm-hmm. You know, when it breaks down, it's like penciler, inker, and colorist. And I know I can't complain about being just a colorist doing the Watchmen. But when the American select system wears pencils, inks, and then color, it can get like slightly, you lose a sense of your own worth to a certain extent. The good thing about Vertigo is the fact that they use a lot of British creators, as I said earlier. So we had the opportunity to like do it the British way, because Karen Berger in particular was like very au fait with what the British creators were doing. And because 2000 AD got it so right, they tried to like engender that sense of what 2000 AD did. But the Americans, you know, I quite like the opportunities like to work on 22 pages. You know, it's like 6 pages is great fun to work on, but if you have to pay your bills, you know, 28 pages is better.
Jesús me mandó, eran dibujos míos. Entonces yo le contesté que lo iba a calcar perfectamente.
You sum that out in a minute.
So essentially, he just said that the American system, as profitable it might be, it might also lead to the making of mistakes. And he just shared an anecdote in which he was working for a book publisher. And he was asked to render his style like someone else's. And when he got sent the samples of that someone else's work, it was actually his own. So.
Yeah. Right, well, on that note, to sum up then, 2000 AD is the best comic in the world. British comics are the best in the world, and I'd like to be an editor, and I am anyway. So thank you very much for your patience. I hope you've enjoyed it. It's wonderful. Thank you very much for your input, Jack. We love it, Joe, Chris, whatever you're calling yourself, because you had so many different names to work under. Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Yuzus. Thank you, translator person whose name I've forgotten. I do apologize.
Guillermo.
And John Higgins. Old bait. And. Thank you very much to everybody for listening. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that, Earthlitz. Sorry about any sound issues. This was, of course, being recorded in front of a live audience. So not everybody's microphone technique is perfect, but I hope you at least got the gist of this panel. An absolutely fascinating insight into the behind-the-scenes work that goes on in creating the galaxy's greatest comic. Join us next week for a regular episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast, and make sure you tune in 2 weeks' time for another amazing panel from the 40 years of Thrill Power Festival. Splendig Vertrig.
Dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000 AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000ADonline. And follow on Instagram at insta2000AD. Program complete. Shutting down.